I want to do a brief review and add one other aspect to what we've talked about in understanding the book of Revelation as a whole and understanding our basic approach to it. I think I covered the first week the two basic views of futurism versus preterism, right? The futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation is that the bulk of the book is as of yet unfulfilled and will be fulfilled sometime in the future. The preterist position is that it was fulfilled largely, not completely, but largely in the first century AD, okay? And that these are prophecies concerning the Roman Empire and so forth. Now, there's one other interpretation I think I should mention, not only to be fair, but to avoid some possible confusion. There is another position called the historicist position, which views the book of Revelation as being fulfilled throughout church history. Okay? And in this view, it is largely an archetypical book. So the beast, in the historicist view, would be the Roman Empire, and Stalin, and Hitler, and the future beast. The beast is an archetype of political persecutors of the church. The futurists tend to be premillennial and tend to say that it's going to be fulfilled in the future, although there are some historicist elements in standard premillennial thinking. For example, one historicist element is that the seven churches at the beginning of the book of Revelation are understood as an outline of church history. So people would say, well, the Laodicean church is not only a church in Asia Minor, but is the Laodicean church age. All right, there's the Philadelphian church age, which was the mission movement of the 19th century, and there's the Laodicean church age, which is the age of apostasy right before the end. Okay, so that's a historicist element in a futurist school of interpretation. So no one of these things can be completely watertight. I am a preterist, but I believe there are some elements of the book of Revelation that are still being fulfilled and are yet to be fulfilled. So there's some futurist elements. So it's a question of emphasis, not watertight categories. Okay. Now, there's one other reason for saying that. Those of you who've heard me teach on eschatology before, eschatology is the study of the last things, right, know that I am, roughly speaking, a postmillennialist. Okay, but don't assume that postmillennialism and preterism are synonyms. They aren't. Some postmillennialists are preterists, and some postmillennialists are historicists. Okay, do you see that? Those are two separate questions. Are you a preterist in your interpretation of the book of Revelation is one question, and whether you're a postmillennialist is another. Now, they're not unrelated, but they are distinct questions. Okay, so preterism means pastism, largely fulfilledism. Futurism is yet to be fulfilled, and historicism is it has been fulfilled, it is being fulfilled, and it will continue to be fulfilled until the Lord comes. Okay? That's three basic schools of interpretation. Now, we've already discussed the identity of the beast, which is the, according to my understanding, is the Roman Empire. The beast is a seven-headed beast. The seven heads are seven hills. Rome was renowned as the seven-hilled city. The seven heads are also seven kings. Five were, one is yet to come. I believe we should start counting with Augustus. Start counting with Julius, not Augustus. And if we do that, the five who were bring us up to Nero. The sixth is Nero. And I believe the sixth Nero is the epitome of the beast, the current ruler of the beast, while John is writing these words. Now, I've also mentioned that I differ with the dating of the book of Revelation that places it in 90 AD. Probably next week we're going to discuss the dating of the book of Revelation, both from internal evidence and then external evidence, and we'll look at the church, the evidence among the church fathers. There's one, I think it's Irenaeus, that is the key passage. We're going to look at the dating of the book of Revelation next week. Nero is the beast, the epitome of the beast, when John is writing these words. Okay, this week I wanted to talk about the beast's head wound. I want to talk about the beast who was wounded and is yet alive. We're going to look at I want to read Revelation 13 and a section there, and Revelation 17. And again, I've got a notebook here because I've got some external sources and citations I want to read to you. Revelation 13, verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Incidentally, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but Rome had ten imperial provinces. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. The dragon is Satan, or the devil. I'm going to return to that in a minute and develop it a little bit. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. I want you to notice especially verse 10. He who kills with the sword will be killed with the sword. Jesus said, he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. There's an echo of that here. We learn that the beast is a persecutor of the saints. He makes war against the saints for 42 months. And the one who makes war against the saints with the sword is going to die by the sword. Okay? Now, let me go up to verse 2, and I want to give a little background on the authority structure of ancient pagan societies. We are denominational Americans. Right? Now, denominationalism is pretty much an American invention. You could argue that the English invented it, but it hit its zenith in America. Okay, we have a free market of products, and we have a free market of ideas, including religious ideas. Right? So you set up your Circle K, and you set up your 7-Eleven, and you have at it. You set up your Baptist church, and you set up your Methodist church, and your Presbyterian church, and you attract people by various means to come to your church in this free marketplace of religious ideas. And we assume that that's the way it has always been. And we even assume that of the occult groups or the cultic groups, whether it's a cult like the Jehovah's Witnesses or whatnot, or if it's an occult thing like Satanists. All right? We think, well, some groups are weirder than others. All right? And they're really off the beaten path, but still they manage to attract some people. What we don't understand, and it's a fundamental misunderstanding when we come to reading the Old and the New Testament, is how the religious structure existed. For example, it says the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. We think of Satan and the bad guys as being spiritual entities that are involved in spiritual wickedness in some way and tempting Christians to sin and so forth. And we don't think of Satan as a deceiver, as it says in Revelation 20, a deceiver of the nations. Okay? When Satan is bound for 1,000 years, he's bound, it says, with regard to his ability to deceive the nations, lead the nations astray. In the book of Ezekiel or in Isaiah 14 is a good example. There is a prophecy that is given by the prophet Isaiah against the king of Babylon. Why don't you turn to that quickly, Isaiah 14. In Isaiah 14, I want you to notice verse 4. Isaiah says that you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, and then the prophecy follows. Now, the prophecy that follows, the scripture tells us explicitly, is referring to the king of Babylon. Okay? But what does the king of Babylon say? Down in verse 12. How you are fallen from heaven. This is Isaiah speaking. O Lucifer, son of the morning. Literally, day star. This is the one place in the Bible where we get the name Lucifer. O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit in the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you will be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Now this has traditionally been assigned to Satan. Okay, it's the passage that people say talks about Satan's fall. Well, the passage tells us that it's talking about the king of Babylon. But there's more to it. In ancient pagan societies, the focal point of religious life in any given society was the king or the pharaoh. Okay, he was the link between heaven and earth. Behind the king was the idol of that particular nation, the god of that nation, and behind the idol was a spiritual entity. Okay, different nations had different entities. Different nations worshiped different gods. And these different gods, the Bible tells us, had real existence. They were not G gods, they were little G gods. They were celestials that had been corrupted or fallen somehow. But they were eager to receive worship to themselves. For example, the king of Tyre, it identifies in Ezekiel, it identifies the entity behind the king of Tyre as an anointed cherub who was in the Garden of Eden, who had fallen. Okay? Now, my point in making all this is that different pagan societies had different spiritual entities behind them, supporting them, giving them authority. Okay? Different pagan empires had different spiritual entities giving them authority. The entity behind Rome was Satan. Okay? The entity behind Rome was Satan. We're told that in Revelation 13. He's the dragon, and he gave authority to the beast to do these things. Okay? When John in Revelation is talking about the synagogue of Satan, he is referring, I believe, to the fact of emperor worship in Asia Minor and those Jews who were in some way conniving or accommodating with the beast. And this, I think, also is the meaning of the great harlot in Revelation 17. The great harlot is apostate Judaism, and this woman who ought to have been God's faithful bride is sitting on the beast, depending on, upon the beast. And the Jews, who should have been receivers of Christ the Messiah, were using Rome as a persecuting instrument to persecute the people of God, the Christians. And you see that through the New Testament. The Jews got the Romans to kill Jesus. The Jews tried to get the Romans to get Paul out of the way. They were trying to use the beast as a way of accomplishing their own desires. Right, so that they were conniving with, or they had a peace treaty with, or some kind of setup with Satan. Now, Christians, because they don't read the Word of God contextually, they don't say, what would my understanding of this book have been if I had received it in the first century? They don't ask that question. They view this as a book that fell out of heaven directly with no cultural historical context. And because they don't have this historical context, what happens? Because Satan shows up in the New Testament a lot, Satan becomes the archfiend. And we become Zoroastrian dualists with God on the one hand and Satan on the other. And God and Satan are polar opposites. But God has no opposite. If Satan has an opposite, it is Michael the archangel. And these two great celestial beings have a fight in the book of Revelation. And Satan loses. Michael wins. Satan loses. And we have somehow poured out all our energy thinking about and understanding the loser. Well, I believe Satan really lost. The beast that he was propping up was defeated. And Satan was bound and no longer able to deceive the nations in this way. When Rome fell, Rome was the last pagan empire. There has never been a pagan empire since. Okay? What did Jesus do when he died on the cross? He triumphed over the powers and authorities, says in Colossians. He made a public display of them. If the rulers of this age had known what they were doing, it says they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. They cut their own throat when we killed the Messiah. So what you have is Jesus, by his death, not only accomplishing the forgiveness of sins, but Jesus accomplished the unraveling of the old system of doing things. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, he says, the world in its present form is passing away. Okay? And I believe he meant what he said. There are no more pagan empires. There are empires and nations which do not acknowledge the sovereignty of Jesus Christ, but they do not have the spiritual entities behind them demanding worship and whom they worship in the way that they had in the Old Testament. That, I don't think, is something that is possible to revive. Okay, now that's all by way of background. I think the dragon, Satan, gave him his power, his throne, and his great authority. Okay, now, it is, in verse 10 it says, the one who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. First, it is a fact that Nero was a persecutor, and he persecuted with the sword. I want to give you two instances of that. First, we know, according to early church tradition, that Paul, the apostle, was decapitated under the reign of Nero. And Paul was decapitated as opposed to crucified or some other thing because he was a Roman citizen. That was a concession to him, or an advantage. But he was killed with the sword, decapitated by the sword, under the reign of Nero. A second example is a quote from Tertullian. Tertullian was an early church father. And he said to his Roman readers, quote, consult your histories. You will there find that Nero was the first who assailed with the imperial sword the Christian sect. Okay? So Tertullian verifies that Nero attacked the church with the sword. As it says in our passage here, he made war on the saints. And we've already discussed that Nero's persecution of the church lasted for 42 months, almost to the day, just like it says here. Nero attacked the church, he attacked the church with the sword, and he did so for 42 months. The 42 months ended when Nero was killed. Well, how did Nero die? Nero died with a dagger in his throat. Okay, he killed himself, assisted by his private secretary, Epaphroditus. As I've already mentioned, he died a somewhat cowardly death. He did not go out like a man, and he only committed suicide because worse things would have happened to him had he not done so. But still, he did not go out with any kind of Roman stoicism or courage. He didn't want to face up to it. He finally was killed with a dagger in his throat, assisted by Epaphroditus, not the Epaphroditus that we know in the scriptures. Okay, now, Nero died with a dagger in his throat, and Nero was a persecutor of the church with the sword. Okay, now I want you to remember something that I covered earlier, and that is that the beast, when we say the beast, we have to mark in our minds what it is we mean. Are we meaning beast, the kingdom, generically considered, or are we referring to one of the heads of the beast who is a specific person? And the book of Revelation uses the title beast for both. The beast can be one of the heads, or the beast can be the whole thing with many heads. So the beast can refer to the empire, or the beast can refer to a person. Now, when beast is being applied to a person, the person obviously can literally, physically die, as did Nero. Okay, Nero died physically and literally. The beast considered as a kingdom is only going to die metaphorically. All right, we can say that the British Empire died, but it doesn't breathe its last the way a person does. We're simply personifying the British Empire and saying, well, one historian thinks it died here, and another historian thinks it died here, and you can debate the issue. When a man dies, it's sort of concrete. Now, there's some debate about it, whether brainwaves or heartbeat or whatever you decide, but it's more objective and concrete when an individual dies. Now, when we're talking about the head wound in verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. Okay? Now, I believe that we are talking here about the beast generically considered. Now, the means of applying the head wound to the beast as a whole would be the wound to one of its heads, the beast, Nero. Okay? But I believe the head wound is to the beast as the kingdom. And I want to read you some various things that happened when Nero died. The first thing is, when Nero died, the Julian-Claudian line of Caesars died out. Okay? The Julian-Claudian line ended with Nero. And that was, in the ancient Roman mind, significant. In order to keep that line alive, one of the things they did was adopt people in order to keep the Julian-Claudian line going. When Nero died, it was over. Now, secondly, and this is the thing I want to emphasize, when Nero died, catastrophe after catastrophe befell the Roman Empire. It was a time of major crisis. It would be hard to overemphasize this. It was such a period of crisis that the ancient Romans thought they had had it. Okay? Let me give you several examples. One is, the year following Nero's death was known as the year of the four emperors, or three emperors, depending on how you count them. After Nero was Otho, I'm not sure, the three emperors were Otho, Galba, and Vitellius. Then the fourth was Vespasian. So within the space of 1 year, there were three emperors, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, all struggling for supremacy. They all reigned just a few months. So as soon as Nero died, one would take the throne, and then there'd be there's civil war and fighting. Another would take the throne, there's civil war and fighting. And this happened immediately upon Nero's death, civil war. And I want to read something out of Tacitus. Tacitus is a Roman historian, not a Christian. He's one of the people I've referred to before. He's someone who mentions the persecution of Christians by Nero, and he does it with no great sympathy to the Christians. You know, he doesn't think the Christians are good guys. He thinks they should have been punished, but Nero took it too far. He's a Roman historian. Read what he has to say. Quote, "The history on which I'm entering is that of a period rich in disasters, terrible with battles, torn by civil struggles, horrible even in peace. Four emperors failed by the sword, three civil wars, more foreign wars, and often both at the same time. There was success in the east," which I think was the conquering of Jerusalem, Judea. "Misfortune in the west, Illyricum was disturbed, the Gallic provinces wavering, Britain subdued and immediately let go. The Sarmati and the Subi rose against us. The Dacians won fame by defeats inflicted and suffered. Even the Parthians were almost roused to arms through the trickery of a pretended Nero," right? Someone claiming that they were Nero come back to life. "Moreover, Italy was distressed by disasters unknown before or returning after the lapse of ages. Cities of the rich, fertile shores of Campania were swallowed up or overwhelmed. Rome was devastated by conflagrations, in which her most ancient shrines were consumed, and the very capital fired by citizens' hands. Sacred rites were defiled. There were adulteries in high places. The sea was filled with exiles, its cliffs made foul with the bodies of the dead. In Rome there was more awful cruelty. Besides the manifold misfortunes that befell mankind, there are prodigies in the sky and on the earth." A prodigy is a sign or an omen in the sky or on the earth. "Warnings given by thunderbolts and prophecies of the future, both joyful and gloomy, uncertain and clear. For never was it more fully proved by awful disasters of the Roman people or by indubitable signs that gods care not for our safety, but for our punishment." Okay? Now, that's Tacitus. And he is not concerned to make John's prophecy come true. He's just recording what Rome is going through.
What year did
I don't know. It was not right in this time. No. It was around that general period, but I don't know the date. Okay, these wars, the wars and all the things that were happening to Rome, looked like death throes. Okay? It looked like Rome had had it. Now, I want you to also mark put yourself in the shoes of a typical Jewish zealot who is fighting against Rome from Jerusalem. Now, what had Jesus prophesied a generation before? He said, all these things are going to happen within a generation. And he said, not one stone is going to be left on another. Jesus predicted that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, and it was going to be a military destruction. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, head for the hills. Now, Jesus predicted, and the Christians believed him, in his statement that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed by the Romans. But from the advantage, and incidentally, when the Judeans revolted, the Christians remembered Jesus' prophecy, and the Christians fled and headed for the hills. They did precisely what they were told to do in Matthew 24. They fled to a place called Pella, where they were spared the fighting. The Christians were not caught up in the mess at Jerusalem. They headed for the hills just the way they had been told to. Now, if I were not a Christian, and if I were a Jew, and I were fighting against the Romans, and the revolt broke out in 67 or so, around 67, 66 or 67, and then the destruction of Jerusalem happened in 70 AD, Nero died in 68. Nero died during this war. And when Nero died, Rome fell into all these civil wars and all these problems developed. And there were three emperors in succession. Vespasian was the general who was besieging Jerusalem. Vespasian finally left his son Titus to finish the job at Jerusalem so he, Vespasian, could go become emperor. Okay, now if I were a Jew, thinking, well, here the capital in Rome has been burned, we're having trouble all over the place, I would be heartened and think, well, you know, we've got a chance. Rome is not invincible. Rome is not going to last forever. Now, we tend to think of the Roman Empire and how could the Jews have been so foolish as to revolt against Rome. But humanistically speaking, it looked like a good time to revolt. It looked like a good time to be doing what they were doing. But Jesus had said no. Jesus had said not one stone is going to be left on another. So the Christians believed that prophecy and left. The others did not. So these wars, the civil wars and the things that immediately followed Nero's death, looked like the death throes of the Roman Empire. Okay, let me read Tacitus again. Quote, "This was the condition of the Roman state," and he's talking about a couple of people entering office. "This was the condition of the Roman state, entered upon the year that was to be, for Galba his last, and for the state almost the end." Galba was one of those emperors during the year of the three emperors. And he says, upon the year, when Galba entered upon the year that was to be, for Galba his last, and for the state almost the end. So Tacitus was saying, we've had it. We're done for. Okay? According to Josephus, during this period of time, Rome was brought near to utter ruin. Ruin being his word. All right? Rome was brought near to utter ruin. Turn to Revelation 17. Okay, verse 1. "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication.'" Incidentally, all the way through the Old Testament, apostate Israel is identified as a harlot. Harlotry, adultery, is the standard application that is applied to unfaithful Israel. Okay? So he carried me away in... Oh, and that this brings up another thing. The book of Revelation is the most Old Testament saturated book in the New Testament. Okay? Everybody agrees that it's a symbolical book, but we can't assign the meaning of the symbols willy-nilly. For example, the two witnesses come out of Zechariah. The book of Revelation is a Christianized version of the book of Ezekiel, beginning with the vision of God and ending with in Ezekiel the new idealized temple, and in the book of Revelation the new Jerusalem. It presupposes a thorough knowledge of the Old Testament in the reading of the book of Revelation, even though there aren't a number of explicit quotes. He doesn't say, as it says in Jeremiah the prophet, but it's filled with allusions to the Old Testament. Okay? Now, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Now, the woman is not the beast. The woman is sitting on the beast. Okay? Now, the beast is the beast that we've discussed earlier. The beast is Rome. The woman is something else. The woman is a harlot. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Now, Judaism, the Jews, were, prior to the outbreak of persecution against the Christians in 64 AD by the Romans, prior to 64 AD, the Christians were persecuted, but exclusively by the Jews, almost exclusively, as far as the record is concerned. The Jews persecuted them up until 64, and then the Romans took over. Okay, so Jesus says, when he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, he says, on you will come the blood of all the prophets from righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the prophet. Right? Now, but the angel said to me, Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. Now notice again, the beast is carrying the woman. The beast is not the woman. The beast carries her. The beast that you saw was, and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was, and is not, and yet is. Okay? Now, I think that reference, the beast that was, and is not, and yet is, I think is a reference to our head wound back in 13. Okay? The beast was, and it is not, you know, it's in severe trouble, and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. All right? The woman is sitting on the beast. The woman is sitting on the seven-hilled city, which is Rome. There are also seven kings. These are the seven heads of the beast. Five have fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. Now, here's, let's be careful here, going through 10 and 11. There are seven kings. If you go, starting with Julius, you have five kings up to Nero. You have five emperors, then you have Nero. Then, right after Nero, there is the, five were, six, and seven has not yet come. When he comes, he must continue a short time. Now, the first emperor, right after Nero, ruled just for a few months. Okay, five were, one is, Nero. When he dies, then the next one is going to continue for a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. Now, the thing that's interesting in Greek, it's talking about Greek nouns frequently have articles. Okay, now the article is like the. There's a definite article like the. And then there is, when we have no article, it can be rendered indefinitely. So when you have seven kings in verse 10, I'm going to translate it somewhat woodenly, okay, signifying where the articles are. There are also the seven kings. The five have fallen, the one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also an eighth, not the eighth. And the beast that's coming, the eighth beast, is not identified specifically as the eighth. It's an eighth. Right? So I think what's happening is John is writing a prophecy. He's giving us the prophecy, and he's saying, specifically, here's where we are, guys. Five were, one is, and then we're going into the future. And then after the seventh king, the beast that was and is not now, and is going to be revived, is still going to be with us. And an eighth is going to continue on the beast tradition. And he is going to perdition. And is of the seven and is going to the perdition. After the eighth, and then the ninth and tenth and so forth, the emperors after that are on the same track that the emperors now are. But that's not my subject right now. Right, so five were specifically. One is right now, specifically. One is coming in a short while, specifically. And after that, indefinitely, there's an eighth. And his character is generally the same as what we've been discussing. Okay? Now, what do we have? When Vespasian left the besieging of Jerusalem to go back and assume the throne, it was as though he did not have the troubles that Otho and Galba and Vitellius had. It was as though Rome were revived from the dead. Everybody was expecting Rome to be a goner. Vespasian came back, and for all intents and purposes, as far as anyone can tell, he would just be another Galba or another Otho or so forth. But as soon as Vespasian got on the throne, things calmed down, and the stability and peace and order of Rome was restored. It wasn't the Julian-Claudian line, but it was recognizably still the beast. It was recognizably still Rome. And everybody breathed a sigh of relief, because that was not something that they could have anticipated. All right? Now, let me say a few words about plausibility. When you are reading a book full of symbols and you're interpreting the symbols, one of the things you want to be careful to do is have the assignments. Well, first, when you're doing interpretation like this, you should hold your interpretations loosely. This book is littered with interpreters. Was it G.K. Chesterton said that St. John the Divine saw many strange monsters in his vision, but none so strange as any one of his own commentators. Right. So, saying that commentaries on Revelation are frequently as bizarre as the book itself and the monsters in the book. So you want to have a certain humility when you're interpreting these things. But one of the best ways to have that is to say, well, am I assigning biblical values to these symbols? This is a biblically saturated book. It's an Old Testament saturated book. Am I looking for biblical meanings for these symbols? Again, to illustrate, how do I come up with the beast as a political entity or an empire? Well, that's from Daniel. That's how Daniel uses the idea of a beast. The beast, the various beasts in Daniel are political rulers, and it's very clear and very clearly identified as such. Well, John picks up this kind of imagery from Daniel. He picks up another set of images from Zechariah. He picks up another set of images from Ezekiel. The Psalms are present in the book of Revelation. So when I'm assigning values to these various symbols, you want to be careful that the values you assign are biblically based. Okay? Now here's the other thing. When you first hear an interpretation that you've not been used to, it seems strange. Okay? If I tried to picture myself 8 years ago listening to what I'm saying now, frankly, I would have had a hard time with it. The Lord took his time disassembling a number of things and putting these back together to get me to the point where I would be even needing to listen to this kind of thing. All right? In fact, I marvel at your patience. You know. Having said that, you have to realize that custom or being used to something gives that something its own plausibility, no matter how implausible it is. Okay? If you're comfortable with it, if you were brought up with it. Now let me give you an example. This is an eschatological truth that even many non-Christians know. Okay? I'll just list a number of things that non-Christians have an understanding of. Number one, Armageddon. What is it? There's a great battle at the end of the world. If you said, what is Armageddon? They'd say, well, it's a great battle at the end of the world. If I said, what's going to happen right before the end? They'd say, well, there's going to be a seven-year tribulation. Okay? Seven-year tribulation is a common feature, commonly understood feature. Another, Armageddon, tribulation, they would have the idea that there's going to be great destruction near the end. Okay? Now, if you grow up in a certain environment, you become accustomed to the mental furniture there. Right? If you become accustomed to the mental furniture, then anything you were taught is going to have a prima facie plausibility. You will give credence to that. So if someone said, to illustrate this, if someone came up to you and said, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I think that at near the end of the world, there's going to be a seven-year tribulation. Okay? You would not have a, if you're modern evangelical, in America, you would not have the tendency to dispute the point with them. You'd say, well, yeah, I wonder if the rapture is going to be at the beginning of it or at the end of it or in the middle of it. But the seven-year tribulation is a given. Right? Everybody just sort of says, okay. Nobody challenges it and says, well, where do you get seven-year, where do we get a seven-year tribulation? Well, it comes from Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks combined with Nero's persecution of the church, which was 42 months, and 42 months is 3.5 years. And 3.5 years is half of seven. Okay, then you put all these things together and say, okay, we've got a seven-year tribulation. But the seven-year tribulation is a given. If someone came up and said, not that anybody would, but if someone came up and said, well, I believe the tribulation is going to be for 52 years and 3.5 weeks, okay, and the Antichrist is going to appear 3 months into it, all right, somebody would say, well, can you back that up scripturally? Do you have a verse? Now, the fellow who says that should have a verse, should have a case for it. My point is that so should everyone else. Something should not have plausibility simply because it is common currency. Right? Just because it's common and just because you're used to it doesn't mean that it is biblically based. You can just say, well, this verse applies to that. Like when we looked at Revelation, when we looked at Isaiah 14, where it cannot be shown to apply to Satan. It can be asserted that it applies to Satan, and if you assert it long enough, it becomes part of the standard orthodoxy, and you have a hard time getting people to even see that the Bible might be saying something differently. Be saying something different, rather. Okay, now, if you take... You cannot come to the book of Revelation without assumptions. You have to have certain assumptions. The question is whether your assumptions are going to be, whether you're going to be aware of your assumptions or not, and whether your assumptions are biblically based or not, whether your assumptions are something you're ignorant of, and whether your assumptions are come from the scriptures as a whole. So if I come to the book of Revelation and my assumption is that these are, well, illustrate. If I see a third of the world being smoked and the oceans, a third of the oceans being wiped out, a third of the population being wiped out, and I see other images like the vials of wrath and other apocalyptic images from elsewhere, like the sun being darkened, the moon not giving its light, and the stars falling, and I say, where does futurism come from? Where does the futurist school get its basic assumption? Well, they look outside and the sun's not dark, and as far as they know, never has been. Okay, they say, well, the moon didn't go out and the stars are still up in the sky. So if this is true, it must be in the future. Okay, that's the assumption. And it is a reasonable one. Okay, it's not something that you say you'd reject out of hand. If you say, well, the Bible's the Word of God, and it says these things are going to happen, and these things didn't happen, then it has to happen in the future. The other alternative is to say that these things that were prophesied are symbols. Okay, symbols do not have to, by their very definition, literally happen. Okay? If something is symbolic, then we have to say that it has an assigned meaning. Now, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, that the assignment of the meanings ought to be biblical and not from the newspapers. Right? So, to illustrate, if I look at the, remember that plague of locusts coming out of the pit in the book of Revelation, the sting in the tail and hair like women's hair and so forth. Well, when I'm saying, well, here's a symbol, should I think, when I look at this, should I think of the prophet Joel and the plague of locusts, or should I think of Huey and Cobra helicopters with machine guns in the tail? Right? Now, you've got a symbol, and you're assigning a meaning to the symbol. Everybody interprets the book of Revelation as a series of symbols. Your assumption dictates where you get the definitions for these symbols. Is it Old Testament and biblical imagery that carries over into the New Testament, or is it something that strikes you from the newspapers? Now, when you've got a good mind, you can draw parallels. Let me give you one. We just read that the beast had 7 heads and 10 horns, right? And I was just reading in a magazine that the European market is going to be an open market by the year 1992. All trade barriers in Europe are coming down. Okay, 1992. And I was looking at this map in Newsweek or whatever the magazine was, and I counted the countries involved. Guess. You know, 10. Okay? Now suppose I'm thinking, revived Roman Empire. And I've got 10 countries. Right? Dispensationalists and futurists have argued for years that because this is so obviously Rome in the Book of Revelation, they've argued that it has to be a revived Roman Empire that is the fulfillment of these prophecies. And they've regarded the common market as the precursor to the revived Roman Empire. Well, this European market, you've got more material for saying this. The difficulty is the source of your symbols is not coming from the Bible itself, it's coming from outside. And I think history demonstrates that we have to be very careful when we get meanings of symbols from outside the Bible itself. What was the Third Reich? The Third Reich was an attempt to rebuild Rome. Hitler wanted to rebuild the glory that was Rome. Hitler was an evil man. Was Hitler a beast? Right? Now, I believe that Christians, evangelical Christians, during the Second World War, could be excused for thinking that something was going on in Europe that may have had something to do with the Book of Revelation. But notice how their assumptions colored how they handled that. Mussolini is the false prophet, Hitler is the beast, and we're in a cataclysmic struggle right at the end. But then Hitler goes down, and all of a sudden it doesn't happen. Well, this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Christians have been getting their meanings for symbols from the newspapers and not their meanings for symbols from the Old Testament. Okay? Do we want to know what Gog and Magog is? Old Testament. Do we want to know who the two witnesses are? Zechariah. Do we want to know who the beast is? What a beast is? The Book of Daniel. So we need to be looking to the Old Testament for our guidance and understanding of all these different things. Anyway, that's what I had. The head wound of the beast, I believe, is dealing with the death of Nero, the cataclysmic struggle that Rome was thrown into immediately following Nero's death, and the Roman Empire was miraculously restored when Vespasian ascended to the purple. The Romans didn't think that was going to happen. They thought they'd had it. Vespasian came back. He restored everything. The beast who was not, and yet was going to be recovered. Okay? Let's pray. Father, thank you very much for our time together. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.